Well, we are sort of in the middle of this series on family, and I want to reiterate how important we think family is, and how important family is to not just us as a church, but how important, how vital it is, how crucial healthy families are to a healthy society, to a healthy culture. I don't know if you know this or not, but when Stalin took over the former Soviet Union, he thought that families were an outmoded thing. And so they sort of de-emphasized families and considered them to be not important anymore. And within a decade or two, chaos erupted in the Soviet Union, largely because they didn't have those family groups that sort of help raise kids, guide kids, and give them the structure that they needed in order to grow up and become responsible, productive adults. And so, and I don't know if it's true, for those of you who are younger, there was Russia, then the Soviet Union, and now it's Russia again, okay? Just a little history there. And so in the former Soviet Union, it was almost impossible to get a divorce. They considered the intact family that important. I don't know if it's still true that way in Russia, but that's how the Soviet Union, that's the kind of emphasis that they placed on family at the time. Sometimes those things are unavoidable, and many times nobody asks for those kinds of things. But at the core of what I want to communicate to you during this series is how important healthy families need to be, not only for ourselves, but for our cult, for our community, for our society, and for the world as a whole. And you know, the truth of the matter is that statistically, Christians don't seem to be doing that much better than the world when it comes to families. And so somehow we have to figure out how to do that better. Not because we have, not just because we have something to say to the world, but because our children utterly depend on us to be and to perpetuate a healthy family for them to grow up in. So that's why we're spending some time on that, because as a church, we want that to be our focus within this community, doing families and doing families really well. In the call to worship, Jordan read from Hosea 11, verses 1 through 8. And this particular passage is one of the great iconic passages of Scripture as it describes God's relationship with Israel that at the time he describes as his son. Sort of metaphorically, but he describes Israel as his son. And in describing Israel as his son, he then goes on to describe the nature of his loving relationship that he has with his son. And I think that we can take from that then, that in the same way that God related to Israel as his son, so he relates to us as his children. Now, some people find this odd. If you come from a place where you have virtually no church background at all, and you sing some of the songs that we sing about how much we love Jesus and how much we adore him and what a great friend he is, for some people it just sounds odd that we can speak and have a relationship with the God of the universe that's that intimate and that close. And for some people, it just sounds almost profane that you would do that, because for them, God is sort of out there. He's kind of big. He's distant. He's remote. He is all powerful, but he's not accessible. And that's how many people in our culture see that. But clearly the Scriptures describe God as a father to us. And not just a father, but as I shared with you last week, in Jesus, in the Lord's Prayer that Jesus taught his disciples, we use the English word father, but a closer approximation of that word really is dad or daddy, our dad who is in heaven. Holy is your name. So here we have in Hosea 11, verses 1 through 8, one of the great and classic, powerful scriptures that describe the nature of God the Father and his relationship with us as his children. And so by that, then, we could extrapolate that if God the Father has a relationship with his children in this kind of a way, that maybe as fathers, we should have that kind of a relationship with our children as well. So we model our relationship after God in that manner. So I just want to reread it. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. So his child Israel was in bondage, enslaved, robbed of their freedom. And so out of Egypt he called his son. But the more I called Israel, the further they went from me. So after they were rescued from Egypt, Israel entered into a long time, a period of rebellion and seeking after other gods. Verse 3, God goes on to say, but I taught Ephraim, another name for Israel, a tribe of Israel. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms. Now, how many of you have toddlers? Does anybody have a toddler? You have a toddler. You guys have toddlers. And so when you teach your child to walk, one of the things that you do is you get down on the floor and you take each arm in your hand, right? And you help balance them and you let them walk towards you. And that is the exact image that you're supposed to capture here in this text. That God avails himself to us in such a way that he's there fully present and he stretches out his arms to us and he teaches us how to walk. He holds us steady. He is careful that we don't fall so that we can learn to do what we need to do and so we can grow and walk and become more mature and we can avoid being injured or hurt or those kinds of things. Not only that, but that, you know, sometimes certain children, when they experience failure so many times, they sort of give up, you know. And sometimes we do that, too, in our relationship with God. We have a tendency to give up too fast, even though God has extended his hands to us. He's holding us by the arms. He's trying to teach us how to walk in this life. I led them with cords of human kindness, with ties of love. And so, you know, we were bound to him. And in being bound to him, we were bound to him in love. I lifted the yoke from their neck and I bent down to feed them. So he humbled himself. He was there, fully present, to feed us in whatever way that we are hungry. I will they not return to Egypt, and will not Assyria rule over them because they refuse to. So despite the fact that God was faithful to Israel, they still were rebellious and sought other gods. And isn't it true that sometimes in our relationship with our children, that no matter how hard we work with them, and if you have toddlers, you have an inkling, but when you get teenagers, you'll have a much better idea of what that is like. And so, you know, sometimes our kids don't take our advice. Sometimes they don't want to follow after the ways in which we've raised them. And yet we're still there. We still love them. We still want to help. And even if they continue on, we don't give up on them, even though for a season in their life they might have given up on us. So he goes on to say, swords will flash in their cities and will destroy the bars of their gates and put an end to their plans. In other words, sometimes in the rebellion that our children may have, and we try to find a safe place in that rebellion, But whatever stronghold we seek to find, at some point that stronghold will fail. The stronghold that we use to harbor our rebellion will fail. Because God is faithful, and because he loves us, and he doesn't want that stronghold to keep us from him. Verse 7, my people are determined to turn from me. Even if they call to the Most High, he will by no means exalt them. Then he goes on to verse 8, how can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel? How can I treat you like Adama? How can I make you like Zeboim? Those were cities that were destroyed and punished. My heart is changed within me. All my compassion is aroused. And so you have this burning love that God has for his children. And so, by extension then, the love that a father has for their child is burning too, or it should be. And so even though bad things are happening, and even though they may be in deep in rebellion and maybe rejecting who we are and what we're about and the values that we've tried, we still love them. So I want to talk about then the biblical role of the father, and this is kind of part two. And I just want to reiterate that in the same way that God has revealed himself to us as our father, so as fathers within a family unit, we are obligated to reveal ourselves to our children. That's the model, all right? So I want to talk, and I don't know that I'll get to all of them, but I'll try. I may have to just go over a couple of them kind of fast, but I want to talk about seven biblical principles through which God the Father has revealed himself that earthly fathers should recognize and imitate. And if you read Hosea chapter 11, verses 1 through 8, you'll get most of these in there in some fashion as well. The first I want to talk to you about is that God, that in the same way that God created humankind, that God created the nation of Israel, so the Father creates his children. He's involved in the creative process. Deuteronomy 32:6, is he not your father, your creator, who made you and formed you? So as our Heavenly Father intentionally created us, as he has intentionally created us, so he takes responsibility for us. You know, there's a lot of creative activity going on out there when it comes to fatherhood, but not always a lot of responsibility associated with it. And that is both within the marriage context and outside the marriage context. In the inner city, for example, of many metropolitan centers throughout the United States that contain African Americans, Hispanics, and whites, the family unit can be as high as 70% matriarchal. 70% where there is no father in the home. And the devastating, and I'm just trying to find other words that I can put with the word devastating impact that is having on children is almost beyond description. So if we are going to get involved in activity where there is the risk of a creational process, then we should be prepared to take the responsibility that is associated with that risk as well. Does that make sense to you? So in the same way that God takes responsibility for us, we take responsibility for our children. And within the family context, you know, that responsibility is diversified. So there are certain things that a mother brings to the context, and there are certain things that a father brings to the context. And they are not always the same, but they are both necessary. So in the same way that the Father, God, created us and he passed on to us certain attributes that he has, so we pass on certain attributes to our children that we have as well. That is not only true of men, but it's true of women. And usually you can look at your kids and say, boy, they get that from their mother, right? Usually whatever's negative, it's from their mother, you know, but not really. But usually you can pick out in your children pretty early on the things, some of the things that you've passed on to them that belong to you and you only. And then you can see some of them that belong to your spouse and them only. And you know what? You have to take responsibility for that. Because, you, for example, if I had a temper problem and I see that my son or daughter has a temper problem, but my wife doesn't have a temper problem, that's really my responsibility. Because I understand it, or I should, and I help my child navigate that part, right? In that way. See, the converse of that would be, let's say you have a couple where the father is an engineer and the mother is a famous artist. And one of their children, it happens to be sort of mathematically inclined, and the other child tends to be artistic. The natural bent is that whoever understands the artistic child is going to spend some time with them to help them navigate that thing about them, as would the father help their son or daughter navigate their ability to be mathematical or left-brained or whatever it is. If you would do that in that way, why would you not do that in the more sort of negative way as well, right? You have to take responsibility for whatever specific attributes you see come out in your son or daughter. That thing is kind of on you. And you should help your child navigate that area of their life. Because it's helpful, is it not? When a father sits down with his son and says, hey son, look, I get the anger thing, as you know, right? Because that's kind of like how I am. But I'm telling you, based on my experience, it doesn't always go well with me when I lose my temper. And it won't go well with you. And guess what? If both of us don't learn to control this, and you lose your temper and I lose my temper, it won't go well for anybody. So you can come up with all kinds of different scenarios, but you get my point. I also want to say that in the same way that the Father has created us, and because He has created us, we give to Him honor. That fathers who create their children are owed honor and respect as well. And we live within a culture that thinks nothing about dishonoring the role and the office of fatherhood in our culture. You've heard me say it before, I'll say it again. I'm just really sick to death of all the sitcoms that make fathers look like idiots the entire time. Now, maybe we've earned some of that. And to a certain degree, I'm going to talk about a little bit of that in a few minutes, but nothing good happens if the primary view that a child has of their father, that he's just like an ungraduated adolescent. Nothing good comes from that. And so I think that we need to protect the role and the office of father in the family. And I think that we need our spouses to help us protect that as well. So, you know, fathers aren't always, I mean, unlike God the Father, fathers aren't always going to be at their best, and they're not always going to say the right thing or do the right thing. But that doesn't mean then that they're always wrong or that they always do the wrong thing. And if they're there providing and nurturing and protecting and caring, then they deserve some honor and respect. And I'll have to say that I'm very fortunate because both of my sons now, to my face, they have always honored and respected me. I'm sure there have been some sidebar conversations that have taken place in the past that I wasn't privy to, but at least to my face, they have always honored me. And I just want to tell you, as a father, I can't begin to tell you how affirming that is and how meaningful that is to me that my sons do that. And really, I mean, I'm sure that I've done some things where I don't deserve that. But they still found it within themselves to honor me in that way. And, you know, and look, I think we all know this, right? When you work hard and you sacrifice to provide, and when you're willing to cheerfully give your life, if anybody ever tried to harm them or take their life, then it's important that you hear from them and that they love you and they respect you. And so it's, and let me just say, as a pastor and as a youth minister, there are many times when I've seen fathers undermined by their spouses for no good reason, other than that they were highly susceptible to how kids play parents off on one another. Have any of you ever experienced that? And so, you know, that's why there has to be very good communication between mothers and fathers on these issues. Because kids are kids, right? So, I want to move on to another one just real quickly and talk about how God the Father as sovereign over us, his children. Sovereign means he rules. He's a ruler. And that because he's God, because he's all powerful, he rules over us. There still needs to be some discussion about what it means for a husband and wife to be different but equal. But how those differences should work themselves out. Now, historically, since the beginning of time, in almost every culture in the world, up until recently, there was never any question about what it meant for a father to be sovereign in his family. And there have been a lot of abuses associated with that, historically. So in biblical language, we call this male headship, and that's not a conversation that's very popular in today's culture and context. But I have found, and Ruth will tell you, I think, that there are invariably times in a marriage as you are raising your kids where you are presented with a situation and you both cannot agree about what needs to be done. But something needs to be done. But you can't agree on what needs to be done. So somebody has to take responsibility for what needs to be done, if it goes well or if it goes badly. And I think in the best case scenario, that's what a father and a husband should be willing to do, is to take the responsibility for the difficult decisions or actions that have to be done, so that if it blows up, it blows back more on him than anybody else. Now, it's interesting in our culture, I think, you know, I want to say, and I'm going to sort of just be creative, I'm just going to speak off the top of my head about what I know about history. I think that men in particular in our culture since the Great Depression have been handed a series of great challenges that have wreaked havoc among men as husbands and as fathers. If any of you know anything about the Great Depression, you know, if your grandparents or parents talked about it, you know how incredibly difficult that was for some families, and what some fathers and grandfathers had to do to make ends meet for their families. And then you had a little thing called World War II, where hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of our men participated in and saw horrific things. And they brought that back with them. And nobody was saying post-traumatic distress syndrome. And I can't tell you how many people I have talked with over the years whose fathers fought in World War II who had major issues as fathers when they tried to raise their family. Do you know what I'm talking about? Does anybody here understand what I'm saying? That they were not emotionally accessible. They probably worked hard. Many of them had drinking issues. Many of them had fidelity issues, intimacy issues. They just weren't the best. And then, so it you go on from that to World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War. I have a family member who's been married and divorced four times. So the burden of war has placed a tremendous strain on the character of men as husbands and fathers. And so what's come out of that, I think, are a lot of families where in pop culture, we've basically written off the necessary role of the father in the family. They just aren't necessary. And I'll tell you, for those of you older remember, old enough to remember, the great watershed of that discussion in our culture was a little sitcom called Murphy Brown. Anybody remember that sitcom? And the sort of like the big brouhaha that, remember Dan Quayle and his commentary on Murphy Brown? And so out of pop culture came this discussion that a family can be whatever a family is. You don't need these primary components to have a healthy family. You know, if it's a mother and Fido and the two kids, that's all that matters. That's all you need. And so what has happened, I think, within our culture is that the primary role that a father can play within the family has been largely dismissed. And it has not been helpful to us. So what are some of the primary roles? Well, of course, you know, you have a husband and wife and they come together and they have children. And so what do they do? What's the discussion that they have? Well, she brings the great gifts that she has, and he brings the great gifts that he has, and they talk about how they make that work within the context of a family. Historically, one of the primary gifts that a father has always brought to the family are two things: protection and boundaries. Now, I understand, that it would be more obvious in an agrarian society where people farmed all the time, or a hunter-gatherer society, or maybe even in an industrial society. But a lot of that has disappeared because we now live in a technological society. But it still doesn't mean that any of that has disappeared. Let me tell you something. I'm 52. I've been doing ministry since my early 20s. And I could have conversations with you that would turn into hours of women who've been in my office in tears, sobbing because they could not prevent their 14-year-old son from doing things that she did not want him to do. That she couldn't prevent him from, as he turned 15, 16, bringing girlfriends home to spend the night. That she couldn't get him home in time to go to bed so that he could get up and go to school at a decent hour. She could call the police and say, well, you know, that's your problem. Well, I want to like smack him. Well, you can't smack him. So she feels oftentimes that her hands, I'll give you some other examples. How about the young, amorous male that's interested in the daughter? She couldn't prevent that from happening. But when that male comes over to the house, and I've heard on this on more than one occasion, and the father is cleaning his gun at the dining room table, it makes an impression. So a father's role oftentimes historically has been this: look, these are the boundaries. And this is what's going to happen if these boundaries are crossed. And it's not that there aren't some women that can't enforce this boundary. There are always exceptions, right? But as a rule of thumb, in this way, men have played a dominant role in history. Protect, how about, again, you know, we have this little thing in business called HR. Because in one of the primary things that we talk about in HR is sexual harassment. Because there are women in the workplace who get these unwanted advances from males. And the same thing happens in neighborhoods. So you have a neighbor, and it's a single woman. And he tries to avail himself on her, and she doesn't feel like she can protect herself. But if she has a husband, you know, you can hear Clint Eastwood, go ahead, make my day. So look, there are these important roles that both husbands and wives play, and that need to be played. And my son Jordan can tell you that I was the enforcer in our family about what the boundaries were and what they weren't. That I took on the role of it's not that Ruth didn't try and protect them. But if it came to like where things got escalated, that was my job. And you would think that in a civil society, none of that is necessary. It is necessary. Because we aren't as civil as we think we are. Well, those are just a few things of the primary things that men bring to a family. And men have to take responsibility for that. Now, later on in the series, I'm going to be talking about things related to women that are both good and bad. But I need to talk about this in a kind of an open way, because, you know, look, if you go to a doctor and you only describe two or three of the five or six symptoms that you have, what's the likelihood that they're going to treat you properly for why you are sick? Not very good. So we have to be intellectually honest about these kinds of things. And I want to say this too. You know, as we, and I want to repeat this numerous times. As I talk about this stuff, if you need clarification on where I'm going with this, I want you to raise your hand. You feel free to interrupt when I'm talking and to ask me a question so I can give you that clarification. And when I talk about this thing particularly about the leadership capacity of men within families, I want to be clear. I'm not being a sexist. I'm saying that men are vital to the health and well-being of a home. And there are certain things that if they take responsibility for that, that most women can't do as well, in the same way that there are some things that women can do that most men can't do as well. And so we pool our resources and our talents and our abilities so that we can have the kind of healthy and productive and meaningful families that we all desperately need in our culture and in our society. Because it's not going well. So on this hill, in this town, in this community, we want to be the kind of church family that is the exception to the rule. And honor the model that God has given to us for our own families. There's more that I have. I probably won't come back and visit it. Maybe some other time I could take a Sunday and do each one of these and really develop them. But we will come back and visit it at some point. So, As you think then, fathers, about your role, if you are a grandfather, if you are a father of teenagers, if you are a father of young children, have you considered your role in your office? Have you thought about what it is? What is the full account that I need to bring? What is the full weight of what I need to bring to this family so that my family is blessed by what I have to offer and what God has given to me in terms of the office of fatherhood within the family? And I want to say this to wives. Do you allow your husband to do that? I mean, might it be that you might struggle with giving him control over certain areas so that he really can do that kind of thing that only he can do? And if not, then can you have that conversation, honest conversation between each other, and realize that there's some vying here for control? And it shouldn't be about that. It should be about a syncretizing of abilities for the betterment of our children.